Good day, everyone. I just want to thank the governor to begin with for coming here today and taking the time out of his very, very busy schedule. I am incredibly delighted and honored to introduce my friend of over 35 years, Jerry. You believe that? You're all aware that Governor Brown has been in public service for over 28 years, including two terms as governor from 75 to 83. And during that period of time, he had 1 year where he had a surplus of $5 billion, which is probably the greatest surplus the state has had in over 50 years. Part of this surplus came from his notorious frugality. I guess you know he is Plymouth-driven, eats only one meal a day sometimes. But the reality of it is I've known him 35 years, and he's not purchased one meal for me or anything for that matter. That frugality is taken too far. Okay. But that's exactly what we need at this time. He is renowned for his keen intelligence, creative problem solving, visionary zeal. He introduced the first tax credit incentive system for rooftop cellular in 1977. He eliminated the depletion allowance in 1975. He's exactly what we need in these turbulent times. Exactly. He is incredibly, brutally practical while maintaining his ideals. You can tell from the current budget negotiations, he's tough and principled. When he said no gimmicks, he meant no gimmicks, ergo the veto. He has an enormous job ahead of him. He needs our support, our real estate industry support, every citizen in the state of California support, and I know he'll put the dreaming back in California. It is with great pleasure I introduce to you the governor of the state of California. He was the 39th governor, but he was also the 34th governor, Jerry Brown.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting and illuminating to come back to a job 28 years after you were in it and see all the changes. Changes in myself, for one thing, the mind, the body definitely alters and evolves, but also in the Republicans and the Democrats, the legislators, the press, things are not the same. Things change. Some things are better, some things are worse. The deadlock between the two parties, worse. The fiscal issues get bigger. Certain amount of skepticism, always part of a democratic society. We don't want to be too confident of political leaders. That's why we're a free country. But at the same time, even though we've got issues, and just this morning the Senate Republicans just had a big press conference out in front of my office saying no. No, they don't want to agree to any tax extensions. Just a generally a rejectionist posture. But hey, that's part of the process, part of the dance. I am determined to get this state on a firm financial footing, and for however long it takes, and whatever it takes, within the law and in an ethical, transparent way, that's where we're going. And I'm going to get there, and with your help, we'll get there a hell of a lot sooner. It's no fun to veto a budget of your own party. And, you know, you have to stand with your friends, which I like to do. But we also have to stand with California and make sure we build for the future and not just steal from it. And we've seen a lot of issues that all of you have been dealing with. We profited, or we thought things were good in the middle of the mortgage bubble that burst. But a significant part of the unemployment is a direct result of the excess of leverage and the kind of loose underwriting that was encouraged by so many people who profited so much at so many millions of other people's continuing loss even till today. But I don't want to just dwell on problems. We should never forget this is not one of the backwaters of the world. Yes, we have people who leave California, but yes, we have people who come to California. We're getting the lion's share of venture capital investment. We're a leading center of research in medicine, in genetics, in stem cell research. We've taken a pioneering role. Just last week, I went to Blythe, California. I'd never been to Blythe. I'd recommend it to those who feel that things are a little hot wherever you are. Go down and try Blythe for a while. Anyway, I dedicated a central-based solar plant that, when it is complete, it will double the amount of solar electricity in the whole world. That's a pretty big statement. But it will pioneer California as not the nation's leader, but the world's leader in the construction and production of central-based solar. That's not the photovoltaics on your roof. This is the large mirrors on the ground. It's an incredible manufacturing feat. It costs $5 billion in the middle, I don't want to say of nowhere, but certainly far from the maddening crowd out there in Blythe, close to Arizona and Nevada. In the desert. And when I flew over, I flew from Ontario over to Blythe because I wanted to look at all the various sites for transmission lines, for wind machines to generate electricity, and some of the solar sites. And you see all this dirt out there, just thousands and thousands of miles of dirt absorbing sun that is of the most powerful in the world. And I didn't understand that, as I got briefed on this trip, that there are different places that have differential intensity of the sun's rays. And in California, near Blythe and a little further away, are the most intense areas on the planet for electrical generation because of the sun's rays. So this is an incredible resource. Yes, it isn't just tomorrow, I mean, it isn't next week, but when you think out, and what does government do? State government doesn't, you know, do a massive jobs program like Roosevelt did in the 30s. States have to build for the long term. The roads, the water supply, the energy, the schools, the university, the intelligent public safety programs. That's the basics that allows a vigorous private sector to flourish. And I mentioned solar, I mentioned the computers, I mentioned the social networking, tourism, agriculture. California is still an engine of economic advance. The number is somewhere, I saw one number at 1.7, I saw another number at 2 trillion, the gross domestic product. That's a lot of money. And this year, it's another 75 billion. The next year, another 75 billion. And a lot of parts of the world doesn't see 75 billion in a year. May not see it in 10 years. So the wealth creation is there. And that's what I think we ought to focus on and then identify roadblocks, remove them where we can, but understand there's not one person in charge. This is a complicated, very advanced society with multiple hands on multiple levers. We have many interest groups. Among some, you have apartment owners, you have agricultural interests, you have the hospitality industry, you have unions of various sorts, you have Republicans, you have Democrats, you have an assembly, you have a Senate, you have a state court, you have a federal court, you have the initiative, all these things swirling around. And to mobilize, to herd these cats, it takes skill, it takes luck, and it takes a lot of the stars aligning in the right way. So I want to tell you this morning that things aren't perfect. We got serious problems. If we make the wrong choice, we can head down the path of irreversible decline. That's an option. It's not one I want to follow, and with all the energy and imagination that I can bring, I'm going to make sure we don't get down that path. We are looking at gridlock in state capital. We're looking at gridlock in Washington. People come from the same country, but they bring a totally different picture of the world. I walk into the Republican caucus, and there is a very plausible worldview that is articulated. I walk into the Democratic caucus, and equally, I'd say more plausible view, but totally different. How the hell do you pull them together? That's the challenge. And it's I think, easier in California than it is in Washington. But we're not there yet. And we're going to have some difficult days over the next few weeks. But sooner or later, we're going to be able to take the wealth we have and keep building on it. There's so many good possibilities here. Doesn't mean everybody's going to make it. Some people make bad decisions. They go bankrupt. Some politicians get defeated. Some come back. So I know, just because I lost in 1982 doesn't mean that there isn't a bright future in 2010. So I may come back 10 years after today and find another spot. Certainly I never thought when I was governor of California that I'd ever become mayor of Oakland. Somebody said, "Governor, you're always talking about small is beautiful. Instead of being governor and wanting to run for president, why don't you run for mayor of Fresno?" I thought that was preposterous. But, you know, time changes. I see an opportunity, and I availed myself of it by becoming mayor of Oakland. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about development. After years of being a homeowner, I decided it was time to become an apartment dweller. And I lived downtown in Oakland for 4.5 years in the Sears loft, a converted warehouse that now became a pretty nice apartment. I enjoyed calling the landlord when things didn't go right. I definitely see the virtues of being in an apartment. But I moved. My wife found a very expensive house up in the hills of Oakland, and I bought it. So I stopped being an apartment owner about 4.5 years ago. But now I'm an investor in apartments, and I'm determined to make sure that everything works well for you and for California. Thank you.
Yeah, you touched on many interesting and exciting topics. Let me just start with one political question, and then we'll move to an economic question, and then we'll talk about our real estate industry for a bit. On the politics side, gridlock has been talked about now endlessly. Do you believe that the new Citizens Redistricting Committee will have an effect? And if that doesn't have effect in changing the districts, what do you think has to be done by the citizens of California to stop this gridlock?
It's going to have an effect. How big the effect is, I don't know. When I saw those new lines come out, they looked kind of like the old lines, just a little different. But the new lines will create more competitive races, and that means there will be more campaigns that you'll be asked to finance. So the first big change is the apartment owners will have to pay more to have the same impact that you had in the last election. So that's unfortunate, but that's the case. But it will mean that there will be more competition, and therefore I think a more willingness to see both sides of the question so you don't become an extreme on one side or the other. Secondly, we have the open primary where a Republican can win Democratic votes and so can look toward a more moderate part of the electorate, and Democratic candidates can look for Republican votes and therefore a more moderating influence as part of the primary. Up till today, each party, and often the more zealously ideological aspects of each party, were the gatekeepers for who was to run in the general election, and there were less than 10 competitive races. So we've got more competitive races, we have more opportunities for people running for office to look beyond the discipline of their own party. So I think that's a positive. But having said all that, there are differing points of view. I think they're best expressed by the debate that we see in Europe and in Washington about, is the answer to our slowdown, the sluggishness in the return to higher employment, is the answer to be more spending, more stimulus, loosening of credit, or is it to have more austerity? And that's a debate. People say if it's more stimulus, then you put more power in the hands of consumers. There's more demand. You get more demand. You get more production, more hiring, and the whole, it's a virtuous cycle. Other people say, well, the long-term debt hangs over us. It scares people, and therefore they're slow to borrow and invest, and therefore we should try austerity, that even though unemployment goes up, people will feel more confident about the future because the debt will be lower, even though for a few years things may get worse. I view the austerity option a very dangerous pathway, but I also recognize that the stimulus pathway has to be linked with a long-term constraint on what is going to be an out-of-control debt that if you get deep enough in the hole, you can't climb out, as we've seen Greece. So I think we've got some mechanisms that are helping us in California. I think our problem is not as great, but it is part of a larger problem with an aging population, two differing points of view that makes it difficult to get agreement because there are just different values that are clashing. There are real differences, and to overcome them, it takes more than a conversation. And I'm trying to find and model ways in California that we can get agreement between the two parties. And I have to say we're not there yet, but I remain confident that we're going to get there in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you. On the economic side, topic on everyone's mind is economic growth. What do we do about it? What can be done? What can the governor do? And I want to sort of take the platform of the mayor. As mayor of Oakland, you did a remarkable job of really allowing that city, which has been overshadowed by San Francisco for 100 years, to be revitalized. You brought people downtown. You incented development. You brought retail. What did you learn from your experiences in Oakland that you can carry forward to the capital as the governor of California and implement to allow us to restart our growth engine, our job engine, our tax engine?
Well, what I learned is first to identify your strength or your asset. And certainly a critical asset of Oakland is its proximity to the San Francisco Bay and to San Francisco, to Silicon Valley, to the universities, Fremont. It's very well situated. And with the BART, the bridge, the freeways, access is quite good. And the weather is particularly good. And the views are fantastic. I always say the view from Oakland west is better than the view from San Francisco east. I say that as a San Franciscan. I enjoy looking at the San Francisco Bridge from my bedroom and from my kitchen in the hills of Oakland. But so what's the asset? Proximity. So people in West Oakland and downtown, West Oakland is 5 minutes by BART from the financial district. Downtown is about 13 minutes. So I wanted to say, let's put 10,000 people downtown. And so first identify the strength, which is a very close proximity to a very large employment center. And number two, to focus on the goal. And the goal was to get as much market housing with people with disposable income and not to look for any other social objective, but rather to bring more disposable income. The downtown Oakland, that census tract, is 50% below the 50% of the people are below the poverty line.
What could you carry, though, to Sacramento from those lessons?
Well, I did want to make my final point was
I
found out that every project was opposed by somebody. And so I never had such a sustained experience of mindless resistance as I experienced as mayor. So I learned that. And what I learned is that people have these larger ideological expressions that are way, way out of whack. When I started military school, there was old Vietnam activists coming in virtually with their walkers saying that Brown's going to militarize Oakland. No, I just wanted to create a disciplined school to get kids into the university. The same thing people would say, no matter what you built, they have an opinion on it. And people, there was always an opposition to everything, including your project on the Lake of Oakland, which is a fabulous project. So what did we learn? You have to crush the opposition. That's all I'm
saying. I have to say, no. I have to say, if you don't know very much about the military school and the art school, you really ought to look into it. Those are models for urban America. A remarkable lesson for all of us. The military school graduates, I think 80% of them go to universities. And it's just a remarkable feat. And it came from an enlightened mayor that looked beyond the narrow views of a lot of people in that community. So I would really encourage you to look into it and to support it if you are so inclined. I'm sorry, Chair.
I didn't want to do an ad there. Well, another thank you.
Thanks
for that comment on the schools. I think patience is important. In my earlier period in politics, I was in kind of a hurry. I ran for president after 14 months. That's real impatience, 1976. But to get anything done, you got to keep at it. And you can't let things, deter you. It does take, you got to lay it brick by brick. And I think you know what, where's the opening, where's the opportunity, and you got to focus on it. You can't do 20 things, you can't even do 10. You have to do a few. And my principal goal in Oakland was market rate housing. In fact, I went to one of the city, one of the more raucous city council meetings, and I stood up and broke the tie. There was a vote, 4 votes for mandatory inclusionary zoning and 4 votes against it. And whenever there's a tie in Oakland, the mayor breaks the tie, and I went in and broke the tie against inclusionary zoning to howls of execration. But I did it anyway because I wanted more disposable income in downtown Oakland. That's what I really wanted. I wanted, because I wanted stores. I wanted Starbucks closing not at 5 o'clock on Friday, but even open on the weekends. And to do that, you have to have people. So I think you got to be focused. And I had a couple of other things, public safety and the arts, to work on the base that Oakland has a lot of artists, get some tourism and create more living space. Now, when you get more convivial living space. Now, when you get to the governorship, how you jumpstart the economy, I think you have to keep the building blocks, which is the university, the schools, the energy, the water, and our transportation. These are the things you got to keep working at, and they do take money. And that's the great dilemma where we are. If we don't fund things, then it's very hard to go forward. But how you fund them is very important. And you don't want to have a type of taxation that retards rational investment and development. So that's kind of where we are today. And there's not a complete translation Oakland to governor, but I got an insight of local government, of specific neighborhoods, corners, projects, problems that in the more abstract realm of state and national politics, one never sees.
And now on our industry. Housing has gone through probably the most dramatic meltdown since the Great Recession of the 30s, and we're still in that process where I think 30-40% of the homes being sold are foreclosed homes. Do you have any feelings or opinions about the housing problem and what the governor or the state might do about it?
Well, I mean, there's large forces that operate in our society, and it isn't given to one particular legislative bill to alter economic cycles, and we're certainly in a particular economic cycle. I would note that it's instructive that just emphasizing home ownership and then letting people buy homes they couldn't afford, betting that things could always be house could always be refinanced later, was not wise, not sustainable, and not consistent with what we've known, what mistakes have made in the past. So I think that is an example where the regulators, the investors, the mortgage people really got carried away. Now we got to clean that mess up. And it'd be very nice if we could reduce the principal on, but, that's not given to the governor. I sued Countrywide and got a $7 billion settlement, which helps. But this is a big trillion-dollar industry. And so how do we jumpstart it? I would think And one particular investment I'm in, the banks have said we have to put up more collateral because they said the valuation's going down. I don't like that. I'd like to have a little looser.
It's a word you're going to learn.
A little more looser lending rules.
Remargining. It's a new word.
Well, that means you have to throw in more capital.
Right.
I don't know. I'm always reluctant to do that. So I think the best thing we can do is to put Sacramento in balance and not to cause you any more harm. I mean, that, do no harm is already a positive good.
Very good. This is a group of primarily apartment investors and builders and service providers to the apartment world. We happen to be uniquely in a fairly good position now compared to the other products within the real estate industry. There are many developers here. Do you think the state can do anything to help the development process of apartment buildings?
Well, I think you have to give me some particular issues that the state could weigh in on. There, land use is quintessentially local, although local is circumscribed by state rules, whether it's California Environmental Quality Act or other housing element or sprinkler requirements or whatever they're going to, plastic pipe. I mean, there's all sorts of rules that the state puts its nose into. So all I can say is we ought to discuss before we add any more and make sure, you know, that we're not doing something that doesn't make sense from a common sense point of view. I don't think the state has the resources to give tax credits or do something on that line. We're already, you know, we've already given a lot of tax reductions. The Governor Schwarzenegger got rid of the vehicle license fee, which is a consumption tax that had been around since the 30s, and that cost the state $7 billion every single year. And also, they got rid of the single sales tax on out-of-state companies. That cost us $1.3 billion. So we've done a lot of that, and then the Democrats have matched all the tax reductions with permanent spending increases. So that's kind of the program to reduce revenue and increase spending. And then how do you balance those two? Watch. It's not a pleasant process.
The governor has a schedule, and we have a couple more minutes. I'm going to ask one final question, then I'll open it up for a couple of questions from the audience. The microphones are there. You did a very courageous and somewhat controversial thing by, I don't want to call it seizing, the redevelopment agencies. Could you give us your thinking behind that?
Yeah, very simple. The redevelopment agencies, on average, are taking 12% of the local property tax. At the same time, the local property tax, the rest of it, is devoted to police and fire, OSPA, medical aid of indigents, as well as public education. Now, when you take away that money, about $1.7 billion this year, then you have to get it from somewhere else, or you have to cut schools, cut police and fire, or the other services. So the state makes that up. It's not a free good. Redevelopment, just take money from the property tax, put it in the redevelopment pot with no consequence. It's less money to the recipients of the local property tax. So then the state makes up for it. Now, when the state had a lot of money and we're in the bubble, okay, we got the money. But when we're last year at the beginning, we were $26 billion in the hole, we're still $9 billion in the red. So how do we make up for this $1.7 billion? Well, that's smoke and mirrors. That's what it's been. So we have to align our spending. And I like redevelopment. We used it to great advantage in Oakland. I think it's complicated. I think there are a lot of things that come with it. I think in many respects it's not all that efficient. If you go do it without redevelopment, you can do it quicker, cheaper, and you can't do it as big or as grandiose. But there are a lot of things you can do. So I like redevelopment, but if I had to choose, I think schools are more fundamental. And I thought we should develop a different redevelopment tool that should be put out to a vote, and then the people could create a specialized source of capital to assist in assembling land and helping with various renewal and redevelopment projects.
One last question. As a regent of the University of California, and you as a graduate of Berkeley, and you mentioned how important graduate education is and creativity is, your thoughts about the budget as it relates to education, higher education in particular, and graduate education in even more specifics?
Well, I'm big on the university. I want to see it prosper. It's key to our economic future as well as our democratic future, because we want critical thinkers, we want knowledgeable people, and we want to keep the inventions and the innovation going. At the same time, we got a budget with a $9 billion hole. Where do we get the money? A lot of the social welfare, medical, we've cut back substantially. A lot of it is constrained by federal rules. We have a prison system which costs us $10 billion. People are very wary of cutting that back too much, although we are. We're doing a lot of things there, realigning it, reducing spending. And then you come down to what's left. And you got schools, and you got the university. And we're short. And this is something, if I make no other point, it is very hard for people, I don't care whether they're a legislator, maybe some people in this audience, to get the idea that revenue is, say, $85 billion and spending is $95 billion. Now, you can play with that with borrowing and kind of hocus-pocus for a while, but we've been doing that since 1998. We haven't had a budget that over a couple of years is truly in balance. And the reason for that is everybody wants, and they can't accept the fact there's a gap. And by the way, if you have a $9 billion gap this year and you don't do anything about it, you have an $18 billion gap next year because the spending doesn't go away and the revenue doesn't emerge. Or are they both change upward? That's the dilemma. Where do we cut? I think the cuts are unacceptable. But what do I do? The previous governors just created a smokescreen and just kind of hoped for the next year, but every year created new problems, and they couldn't get to the goal of balance. We can get to the goal of balance because we've already taken $12 billion in cuts or various other budget solutions, and all we need is to extend a couple of taxes, the sales tax, the income tax, and the vehicle license fee for another 4 or 5 years. And I think we'll be out of the woods. But because there's a doctrine that a tax is evil and the public sector is essentially just wasting money, we're not going to let you vote on it. That's what some of the Republican people are telling me. Well, if that's true and we can't – by the way, this is not to vote on a tax by the legislators. This is to let the people vote on whether they want it or not. So what's really at stake here, is there enough democratic respect to let the people decide on this? I think it's very important that we continue funding the university, not at its current level, but at a higher level, and that our public schools come closer to other public schools in the country. We cannot do that with more revenues. We must continue to retrench, and that is not pretty. It's not pretty at all, and I'm going to do everything I can to get those revenues. I can only get them now, in the next few weeks, if we get 4 Republican votes. Otherwise, we'll have to go to an initiative, and it will take us the better part of a year. But I'm going to tee this up so that all of you and the people of California can weigh in. If we are going to go on a continuous decline of funding in schools, we ought to at least do it with our eyes open and realize that in California today, 50% of the children born are born in relative poverty. And that's why their births are conducted under the Medi-Cal system. They're eligible for Medi-Cal because they're poor. And we know if you look at who goes to college, university, and all the other social indicators, it's not good to start out poor. And half of our future is poor. At the same time, we have wealth, we have innovation, we have Facebook, we have LinkedIn, we have the iPhone, we have Chevron, we've got the biggest solar plant coming online in the whole damn world. So it's a tale of two cities here. And we've got to come up with something balanced. And it's not about ideology. It's not about left or right. It's just looking at the world, an aging demographic, if you want to call it that, a shifting demographic with more Latino, more Asian, particularly in our society, and how we all going to get along and make it work in a smart way. That's the big challenge, and that's why a lot of people in my job don't do so well, because it's very hard to herd the cats and get the irreconcilable opposites to find common ground. And that's the great challenge ahead of us. But I think we have a path forward, and I'm just announcing it to you. This path forward is real, and it will take us a while to get there, but we're embarked on it.
Thank you very much. I did promise. Any questions from the audience at all? If there are none,
yeah, there's
there is
one right there.
There is one.
Hi, thank you, Governor, for being here. Great dialogue. A couple of key questions. There's been a discussion about California being fundamentally flawed. There were a couple of efforts to amend our Constitution, and the fact that too much of our income is dependent upon personal income tax, which is very volatile. I know that coupled on top of that is the proposition system, where there are a lot of unfunded mandates that are approved by voters. Do you personally think that we do have the tools in place today to fundamentally fix California's fiscal system? I know you've talked about different solutions, but do we really need to remake it and look for a new way to fund our government going forward?
Let me just start by saying I get very wary when I hear the word fundamental. Fundamental sounds like we're talking about, I don't know, creation ob nihilo. That's creation out of nothing. This is big. This is almost theological. Fundamental. Radical. We don't change the body politic in a fundamental way, just like we don't change our own bodies in a fundamental way, however much we might like. We can alter. We can make some improvements. We can avoid some mistakes. But we can make changes. Now, we're not Greece, we're not Spain, we're not England. This is a dynamic economy. I had a meeting with 10 entrepreneurs. There, three or four of them had IPOs. One was LinkedIn. Another was Drop. All these social media guys. I don't know what the name of it was. Dropbox or whatever the hell it is. You put all your data through it quickly. Anyway, these people are totally optimistic. Wealth is being created. They can't find enough people to hire. They're renting new space in San Francisco and in here in the West Bay. One of the terms thrown around, there are 4 million unfulfilled jobs in America. So there's this, there's a lot of talent here. And we've got to invest in that. At the same time, we can't let the social structure become so out of kilter that you have this mass of desperate people without skill and without real buy-in to our society. And that means schooling, that means decent income and jobs. So the state's part of all that is to keep its own fiscal house in order. And that could take some changes to the Constitution, might even take a constitutional convention. But the key point is to get some agreement among leading business and other academic, environmental, labor leaders, church leaders even. You know, a society is not a big lump. It has a hierarchically distributed set of roles and responsibilities and leadership. And those who have more capacity and more position have got to go get out of their comfort zone and work for the betterment of the state. And as governor, I take it as my job to convene, to motivate, and to lead this disparate group of leaders down the right pathway. And that will take some constitutional changes. It will take the use of the initiative in all probability. And it takes continuing working with the legislature without in any way being worn out by the protracted nature of the way that process works.
Thank you. Dean?
Governor, thank you for being here. You were a great mayor in the city of Oakland, and you've done a lot of good things for this industry the last few years. And as a result, you have a lot of friends in this room. The old governor, Jerry Brown, helped create CEQA many years ago. Will the new and improve Governor Jerry Brown, help us eliminate or modify CEQA in the state of California.
First of all, did you say, remember, California Environmental Quality Act was enacted in 1969. Ronald Reagan was governor and Richard Nixon was president. Now, did he really know what he was getting into? Ronald Reagan, I doubt it. And the reason is that laws are created at a level of abstraction that allows them to evolve endlessly. And that's what's happened with CEQA. The courts make rulings. Those rulings have a certain logic. The logic is extended in new rulings, and away you go. But here we are. And I put certain proposals on the table with the Republicans negotiating on a tax extension. Hopefully they'll accept some of them. Are they the full answer? No. But there are a lot of competing forces here. And I am committed. I would like to see greater CEQA reform. Certainly in Oakland, I sought an exemption, which it took me 2 years to get, where for 3 years, the downtown Oakland was exempt from that aspect of an environmental review that requires alternative analysis, analysis of growth-inducing factors, or an analysis of cumulative growth. That would reduce the ability of people to contest it in court. Today, you know, whenever you say alternatives analysis, it's very hard to say there's not a better alternative. Maybe that's the reason why I waited to 67 to get married. I was always, was there a better alternative out there? Actually, I find the best alternative at all, but I was a little slow. But so alternatives analysis is an area. You've got to constrain it so you make litigation more difficult, and there are other things that we could do.
One final question. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for being here. I run a nonprofit affordable housing company. We have something like 4,500 units. And I'm experiencing a huge spike in demand for the affordable homes that that we provide. And I'm also finding that it's getting increasingly difficult to find funding to build additional homes, particularly with the redevelopment agencies poised to disappear. And while I understand that the funds are needed for education, it's also equally very hard to educate children who are homeless. And I think we're on the cusp of a huge increase in homelessness in the state. How can we reconcile the two, provide for education and for decent homes for family of slender means?
Well, that you've just stated a conundrum. We need shelter. We need health care. We need good schools. We need good roads, but everybody wants to reduce the fees or the taxes to pay for that. So now efficiency is great, but can the affordable housing is basically taking the tax credit or funding from redevelopment or something, making somebody else pay for it by inclusionary zoning or a public goods charge or a linkage fee or some darn thing, and then giving it to somebody else. And the somebody you give it to is a very small subset of similarly situated people who would like to get it also, but can't get it because there's never going to be enough money. So it's kind of like a lottery. And basically, if you cut the housing subsidy by half, you could probably give away more money and maybe do more good than pouring it through the housing system. But that wouldn't make you happy either. So I'm not quite sure what to do. I think you've stated a real point. People need housing. If you're going to do tax credits or you're going to do all the other sources, it takes some government mechanism, which you've got to take from Peter to pay Paul. And how do we do that? Because most people say we're overtaxed. If we're overtaxed, we have to have a lid. If we have a lid, there's no way forward. And we have a lot of issues. That is the dilemma where we are. And that's why people like to look at one piece of the problem. And you have said, how do you do schooling without housing? I think you have to hold that idea, and we have to do what is required. And it probably takes more money. And that's why I say we've got to extend some taxes. People say, well, that's bad. The Tea Party says no good. Talk show people say no good. Well, find another way. And here's really the dilemma. In surveys that I've seen, when you ask people, pick a number of how much government, state government, is waste. It's wasted. And the number that best represents the majority view is 40%. So 40% people believe, the majority believe 40% of everything state government does, whether it's the, you know, this is the university, the prisons, the roads, the water, and all the rest, is 40% waste. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not true. Yeah, there's plenty of waste and there's things you don't like, but maybe somebody else does. So in a democratic society, we've got to accommodate contradictory demands and desires and preferences. And when things are growing, we got a lot of money. And then we can make people relatively happy. When we have less money, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where we are now. And we have to knock heads together and get leaner, more efficient, more nimble, more creative. And I think that's the path forward. But finding more money for affordable housing in the next year or two, I would say, is going to be problematical. But I wouldn't count, I wouldn't be to write the obituary of the redevelopment agencies. They're very powerful, and so far they're alive and well, despite my best efforts.
So Governor, I'm gonna pull Chairman's rank here and ask one final question. When I talk to investors a lot, the elephant in the room is Prop 13.
Yeah.
Is a modification, either complete reversal or some modification of Prop 13, an answer to some of the state's issues?
Well, as a politician, I wouldn't say it is. A change here. That's a third rail. But it's also, you know, people, my own aunt who lives in her house, she's had it since 1940, she's 99 years old, she has a low property tax, mm-hmm. and that's very helpful. So I'm very mindful of that. There will be probably moves if the taxes are not extended. I believe there will be efforts to accelerate the reassessment of commercial property or other efforts. I think the core of Prop 13 is very important to Californians. I do not think it's going to be changed anytime soon. A lot of commentators say, you know, that's our problem. Well, if you look at the turnover and the amount of property tax generated today than at the time of Prop 13, property taxes have grown. They have not shrunk in any sense of the word, although you've got to compare it over time and apples to apples and take into inflation. But my hunch is the property tax is still a very significant source of funding. And so that's not our problem. Our problem is if we had a more balanced tax structure, if we had a cap on the spending so that if in a boom year we took the money and paid down debt so we didn't create a fund to pay for commitments forever, for rising salaries or other programs. That's what is done. I mean, there's a lot of ways to deal with the anomaly of the ups and downs of the income tax. I think a broader tax base would be good, lower the rates, spread it out, but that becomes very difficult because any time, as Arnold, he had a little committee, and the Republicans didn't agree, and the Democrats didn't agree, because if you lower somebody's tax, they don't believe it. But the people who you're going to raise as a consequence, they fight like hell. So any change in the tax code is very difficult. That's why, and you can cut a little, you can increase a little, but massive readjustment is rare. And when you have it, as we got in 1984, you get a lot of unintended consequences. So that's why I'd say beware of fundamental change.
Thank you so much, Governor.
Please join me in thanking George and Governor Brown.
Thank you
so much.
Great. Thank you.